From Connecticut Public Radio in Hartford, this is Audacious. I'm Kyone Wolf, and I've got goals. Daily goals, like meditate, move my body, write. Weekly goals, like making sure I remember to water my 76 houseplants, and, well, getting this show to you. As for yearly goals, I mean, I don't know. A whole year feels like a lifetime, and there are a few things people can commit to for a lifetime, so when I start to ponder my long-term goals, they get real ambiguous, real fast. I guess I can commit to being more present, being kinder to myself, maybe I could be more generous with my time. All good things to strive for, but they're all sort of immeasurable. But the three people you're going to meet today decided that their yearly goals were going to be specific and big. One French man took a year to learn English by watching hours of American and British TV shows. And you'll meet a woman who fulfilled her quota of getting 100 rejections about things she cared about over the course of a year. And then there's Kelsey Weekman. She's a culture reporter for BuzzFeed based in New York. And in 2021, she read 12 books. But in 2022, she committed to reading 365 books. And by the time the year came to an end, she finished 390 titles. We spoke at the end of December, and I asked her to tell me, how did this plan come to be?
It wasn't really an idea. I just started reading, and then I was hungry to read more. Like, I just kept picking things up that I kept going. And after about, I guess, a month or so of reading a book every day, I thought, okay, what if I just did this for the whole year? And I didn't think that was possible either, but it just kept happening. It was a very strange situation, but it definitely, I love reading and I'm really excited that I got back into it this year, but I did not expect this to happen at all. I read 12 books last year, so I was just happy to have, you know, regained an interest in reading at all. But yeah, it just happened very suddenly, I guess.
Was it the commitment that you had to live up to, sort of? And did you like speak the words aloud to yourself and your dog, or was it to a larger community base that you had to be held accountable? How did that go?
I do love accomplishing things. Like, the feeling of having finished a book is very satisfying. You get to log it on all these different apps. I take a picture of it and I post it on Instagram. And so I'm like, okay, what are the colors in this book that would look good with what, you know, colors in the background I have? You know, like, I already start thinking about the satisfaction of having finished it. So that kind of propels me on to the next thing. And then I'm a writer for BuzzFeed News, and I wrote about how I had done it for 6 months. And I was thinking, okay, well, I have at least, you know, accomplished 6 months. That's pretty incredible. But once that was out there, I was like, okay, I have to finish the whole year. Well, I've written this down and now I can't fail. I'm not a quitter.
Okay, so content. I want to know the books that stood out in terms of really messing with you. Because some books are kind of predictable and that are entertaining and maybe they made you laugh. But the books that, I don't know, you were proven wrong about something.
Well, the first one that comes to mind is that especially in the online book community, everyone talks about The Secret History by Donna Tartt. It is just everyone's favorite book. Everyone loves it. I didn't think that I was going to like it very much because I tend to not enjoy hype. I like to read like books that are weird or books that no one has read yet. Like, you know, that is a whole other thing, is that when you get books for free from publishers so that you can review them, you get them before everyone else, and then the books are free and books can be expensive. So you're like, okay, keep giving me the free stuff. And then it's, you know, you're kind of blazing your own trail in terms of what you like. But The Secret History sucked me in. I read it like three times. My husband got me a really nice copy for Christmas and I'm going to spend some time annotating it. But I just got so sucked into that world, and it came out in the 90s. Like, it's not a new book. Donna Tartt is not a new author, but I was just shocked that I could be pulled into a world as much as I was with that book, especially given how frequently I jump around from book to book. Because it's like, it's not even just each day is a different book. Sometimes a book is 3 days. Sometimes yesterday I read 2 books in one day, you know, but I'm constantly jumping around. I don't really linger, but I just keep coming back to this book. It feels really special. It's just intriguing and it's built to make you obsessed, basically. And I thought I was stronger than that, but I am certainly not. And it's fun and I love it.
If I start watching a movie and it sucks, I will turn it off. I will walk out of the theater. My time is too precious. I don't feel bad about it. Much like books, if a book isn't really, I don't know, wrapping me around its finger or getting me in some way, I'll close it. I don't want to waste my time. You were under some different circumstances where you had a goal. And so were there any books where you were like, please make it stop?
If I get far enough into a book, I will just finish it and I'll just not enjoy it. And that is kind of, it's unpleasant because you don't want to spend your time focused on something that you're not enjoying, especially a book. Because, you know, a book is a bit longer than a movie usually, and it requires a little bit more of your brain because you have to imagine, obviously, you know, the setting and the characters and such. But I love to put down a book that I'm not going to finish if I don't have an audiobook or if it is a new release that I am kind of reviewing, or if I'm just not having a good time. And I guess there's not a way that I can trick myself into wanting to do it. Because a lot of times, like say there's a character that I don't like, the character's a bad person. Well, the character's probably a bad person on purpose. And so I can kind of trick myself into thinking, okay, well, this is a new experience. This is a different kind of mindset. I'll be fine. Sometimes it is too painful and I have to put it down. One of my biggest, I guess, hacks for reading quickly is that when a book starts to slow you down because you're not having fun, you should put it down. You shouldn't worry about the number of the day because the momentum that you have from enjoying reading is absolutely the secret to reading so fast and so much.
It is so easy for so many people to zone out while they're reading. What advice, if any, do you have?
I would say no one zones out more than me. I zone out all the time. I have just created kind of a, you think about, when you think about reading, you might think of like being a kid and reading in your room and under your bed with a flashlight and all that. You have your area, your zone. I create that on my phone. Like when I have my Kindle app open, right, I have it set to infinite scroll, so I don't have to turn pages, so I don't have to think about how far along I am or when the chapters end. I make it look like my favorite font. You can change the background color. Like you can just customize everything for what sucks you in. So that helps a lot, I feel, with getting distracted. I also recommend, I love audiobooks. I will talk about audiobooks all day, every day, but speeding those up so that you really have to pay attention to know what's going on. I know that that's an absolute sin in audio engineering.
No. Kelsey, you have a friend in me. I listen to a lot of books and a lot of podcasts. And for the most part, like I'll start off, I can tell by how they speak in the beginning. There are a few very slow talkers. This is one guy, Matt Kahn, and his slow talk is deliberate because of the messages he's talking about. But I could stand to get these messages and they get through to me faster when I bump him up to 1.5. But there are some people, you bump them up to 1.5 and it's just too much. So you start getting a feel for the speech of the author. And I think that's a tool.
It is.
If you don't need to use it, you don't need to use it. But it certainly comes in handy and you also can get through more faster.
Yeah, I find it really helps me paying attention. But there are a lot of, you know, there are a lot of hacks I can... If I'm trying really hard to get through something, let's say that's really long and that requires a lot of attention over a long period of time, I will make sure that I am, you know, listening to an audiobook and doing the laundry or I'm doing a project with my hands. And so you kind of, it's like a treat to listen and to focus in. Like the book is the distraction from life. That way you can kind of trick yourself into being focused on the book. I also really recommend short books for people who are just starting to get into reading. You don't have to read short books forever, but just that feeling of accomplishment and the feeling of doing something straight without being distracted is absolutely huge. Another big part of the online book community especially is doing what's called reading sprints, which is just reading for a certain amount of time period and then taking a break And it's, you know, it's programmed that way. So you have your break coming, but you don't think about taking a break until it's break time, until the alarm goes off and it's time to do something else. So you can really do all sorts of things depending on why you're getting distracted. Like if you're a person who likes to check their notifications, just do it at the set time. If you would rather be reading Twitter, make your apps look like Twitter, things like that.
What were the makeup of the books that you chose? You mentioned that it's easier to get lost in fiction and nonfiction is more difficult. By the way, when you said that, I remember the book River of Doubt by Candace Millard, and it was about, I don't really care about Theodore Roosevelt. It's not like I grew up thinking I want to know everything about Theodore Roosevelt.
Right.
But this book, The River of Doubt, Theodore Roosevelt's Darkest Journey, was so compelling that like I remember it was like I felt feelings about reading that I'd never felt in my life when I was reading that book. And I felt like completely changed. And so that being said, this whole year, you've been going through all these different kinds of books. What genre, dare I ask, because I know genrefying anything is kind of lazy, but what of the genres really changed you?
I have data. I'm really excited to be able to answer this with data. But I read 80% fiction, 20% nonfiction. Most of the books that I read were either fast or medium paced, whatever medium paced means. I think it just means not slow.
In terms of story flow? Or?
I guess, yeah. Like you go through them fast, the plot passes you quickly. There's a breakdown of moods that I read, and the top four that are pretty evenly split are reflective, dark, emotional, and mysterious. So those are all words that I would use to describe books that really hook me, right? And make me want to read faster and read more. But my top genres are actually really boring because it's like literary fiction, contemporary fiction. I just said that I like things that are, you know, thrilling and help me get through them quickly. But I also really enjoy reading things that are just a slightly different perspective from my own. Things that are set in a, you know, a current time, with a character who is not me, just anyone else's brain who is not mine. And then you've got, there's some like horror and thriller also in there. I didn't realize I would like horror so much, but I really enjoy being unsettled when it's in like a controlled environment. One of my favorite books this year was Dracula, which I didn't think that I would like as much as I did. I like a classic, but I don't read only classics, but this was a long, old book, but I had a blast. It was so much fun. So
what's the name of that app that you enter your stuff into? Is it sort of like Tapped for beer drinkers?
I think that's the perfect app, and I think they should have something for like every single hobby that's like that. The one that I'm using right now is called, well, you can't see it, but it's called Storygraph, and then Goodreads is the more popular one. It's Amazon owned. This one is not Amazon owned, so a lot of times people prefer it. But they both help you track your goals, and there's a social element so people can see what you've been reading. And
so you post them in both, you update both.
I do. The logging is part of the fun, I will say. Like the joy of like seeing a little goal tracker go up a little bit every time. Whew, love it.
You know, you have me thinking about, I know you're married, so this may not apply to you, but those stats and what they reveal about you would be kind of cool as a dating app.
Right.
Like a book-based dating app. Does that exist?
Listen, I haven't heard of one. I also haven't dated in like 8 years or something like that. But I would also love to just like find a friend who has the same taste in books as me. A big thing, and again, the like online book community, is buddy reading. So reading a book at the same time as someone and then just kind of like texting them, oh my gosh, I can't believe that happened, and stuff like that. And so like finding people with similar tastes so that you can have that shared experience would be so fun. But also I know it would be distracting for me because I would be like kind of reading performatively to be able to.
Well, also you don't know if like the algorithms want to match you up with somebody who is looking for the performative book reading that you're doing, so it might act against you to act performatively in the dating pool, but you're not dating. So anyway, we'll figure this out in my next job as a reading dating book app developer. So you're going to do this again?
I'm not sure that I'm going to make my goal 365 because there are some longer books that I want to get to. And there are some projects that I want to get to outside of reading. But the more that I think about it, the more I think, yes, I'm definitely going to do it. So maybe the answer is just yes. Maybe I shouldn't worry about how it seems if I fail, because ultimately it's just fun. Like I'm doing this for fun and not because it's something to brag about, even though, I mean, I think it's a good accomplishment, especially given that I read 12 books last year, which also isn't nothing, but it is a lot less than 365. So it's possible.
Well, Kelsey Weekman, thank you so much for talking with me. Congratulations on your accomplishment.
Thank you. This has been delightful. So thank you for making my morning so much brighter.
When we get back, when you learn a whole language in a year by watching TV shows, what do you learn about what we all have in common?
It would always come back to the same problem, like someone who's got their heart broken, someone who got a problem at work, someone who got the problem with their kid. It's always the same thing.
Plus, what it felt like to get 100 rejections over the course of a year. I'm Kyone Wolf. This is Audacious. Stay with me.
More books I want. More books. April, August, June, and May. I read a book every day. I read a book every day.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford Healthcare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford Healthcare. A lot of people struggle with sleep apnea and with CPAP machines. Dr. Carl Muller, a head and neck surgeon with Hartford Hospital, describes Inspire, a surgical alternative to the CPAP approach.
Only about 60% of patients can tolerate CPAP real well. Inspire is a surgical alternative to CPAP. It's an outpatient surgery. It takes about 2 hours. And essentially what it does is it picks up when you're taking a breath and sends a 2-second electrical pulse to the tongue, which causes the tongue to stick out a little bit and stiffen and prevent the airway from collapsing.
Hartford Hospital has performed more than 200 Inspire therapy surgeries. If you've tried and failed with CPAP, you could be a candidate for this minimally invasive procedure.
Patients with moderate to severe sleep apnea are candidates. There is a weight criteria, so you have to have a body mass index below 35, and you have to have tried and failed CPAP.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
This is Audacious. I'm Kyone Wolf. Have you ever heard a word or a phrase from a TV show and it just got lodged in your vocabulary forever?
It's gonna be legend. Wait for it. And I hope you're not lactose intolerant because the second half of that word is dairy.
No.
Legendary.
Clothes.
Treat yourself.
Fragrances.
Treat yourself.
Massages.
Treat yourself.
Mimosas.
Treat yourself.
Fine leather goods.
Treat yourself.
It's the best day of the year.
The best day of the year?
Hey. How you doing?
No soup for you!
Oh my God! They killed Kenny! You bastards!
I want to go to there.
To boldly go where no one has gone before.
Truth is, we've all learned language from the media swirling around us, and for better or worse, it's expanded our vocabulary. But what if you use television shows to learn a whole new language? Or five. Matthias Berra is French, and when he was learning English in high school in 2006, he noticed that a couple of his classmates were advancing in the language much faster than he was. So he asked him, how are they doing that? Well, turns out they'd learned so well by spending their free time watching hours of American and British TV shows. They'd start by using French subtitles for a couple months, and then they'd change it to English subtitles for the next few months. And then, total colloquial freefall. So Matthias committed to watching at least 3 hours of whatever shows he wanted to every day for a year. After absorbing close to 800 hours of shows like Big Bang Theory, Weeds, Eureka, Scrubs, and, well, stay tuned to find out what his favorite show is, he now speaks 6 languages. In order of fluency, they are French, English, Japanese, Spanish, Korean, and Chinese. And he's currently learning German using the same method. I wanted to know, of all the shows he watched, which genre was the most effective?
I'd say for me it was comedy. There was a bit of a, I like to laugh, which who doesn't? And so there was this. Also, I think this is less common nowadays, but most of the comedy, like the comedy shows, were 20-minute shows. Well, now there's a few left. Obviously, you've got your South Parks and whatnot. But like, I still feel like back then that was like 2006, 2007. So that was a while back. And back then you had like, so How I Met Your Mother, Scrubs, The Big Bang Theory. Like that was the beginning of all those shows. And they were like easy to get in, get out, get in, get out. The topics stayed the same. It's always like you had a slice of slice of life shows, and so similar topics, but brought in a different light. Always fun. So yeah.
You also had the opportunity to get a glimpse into humanity, at least in pop culture in the 2000s, right, across different cultures.
Yeah.
So I'd like to hear what we here in the United States or in the English speaking world broadly have in common with other cultures that you've learned as well through the media you've taken in.
Through the media, right? I'd say it was a bit of the laid back way. Like, for instance, like one of my favorite shows is still that I've already mentioned was, and it still is, How I Met Your Mother. It hasn't aged that well in some parts, but it's still a good show. And what I liked is like they would sit in the same bar and just talk about like, I don't know, like they would always have problems which were like very, even though back then I was still in high school, they were relatable. Americans are not the same, like don't act the same way as French people do. But yeah, everybody has the same problem in the end. And so no matter where you're from, like no matter where, like, well, like how far you go, you still, and like no matter how messed up the idea behind the show is, like it would always come back to the same problem, like someone who's got their heart broken, someone who got a problem at work, someone who got the problem with their kid. It's always the same thing. Yeah, I found this to, like, later on in life, I found this to be true no matter where you go, no matter which language.
It's comforting.
In a way, yeah.
Right now, English and Chinese are by far the most spoken languages in the world. And I know you're not psychic, but what do you think about the evolution of language? Do you think like everybody's going to eventually speak English or Chinese or Esperanto? What do you think about the evolution of language?
No matter how much we want to control a language, the language is going to evolve no matter what. Like we have in France, we have the Académie Française, which keeps on trying to regulate the French language and say, hey, those English words can't come in. Like they tried to change the word for streamer, which we use in French as streamer. They were like, no, it needs to be. And then like that was like a long expression that nobody's ever going to use. And obviously, everybody complained. Everybody goes like, no, you can set it, but we don't care. Language is going to evolve no matter who tries to control it. It can get frustrating. I don't get some things of French I don't understand anymore, like from like the younger generations. I feel old when I say this. But yeah.
Me too.
But yeah, I think language is attached to culture. And the way we speak, like the way I speak French is different from the way people from south of France will speak French, or how Canadian will speak French, or Belgium will speak French. Same thing for English. It changes. I recently had a conversation with an American linguist who lives in Japan, has been living in Japan for a long time. And so it was him, a friend from India, and myself. And we were talking about the English, the evolution of English and ChatGPT, etc. And basically AI evolution, what's proper English? In the end, my friend from India has really great English, but would an AI consider his English as proper? Maybe not, because it's not the standard accent, it's not the standard construction exactly, but it's still proper English. It's just a different version of English. And so in the end, languages will evolve. I don't think we can imagine how much they will evolve. But they will just old English. Think old English. Would you consider old English as like a better way to speak English?
Yeah, and I think about how you mentioned how language is culture, and part of culture is our media and what we're all absorbing in these TV shows, etc. And so there's a, I feel like there's sort of a give and take between, we inform what ends up on our screens, but our screens sure as hell inform us and how we speak.
Exactly. Especially now with all like, YouTube, TikTok, etc. Like all those have like, there's so much more media. Like before it was in a way controlled by like, hey, what's going to be on your TV screen? There's like, that's the limit of what you can ingest like as information. Now we've got like a small, like we've got even way better than a TV in our pocket at all times. And so we get way more information daily. And so basically the way we speak changes every day, whether we notice it or not. Sometimes I like to, like, I do notice my own, I can recognize my own accent. The way I speak will change like drastically between how, like, if I spend more time in France, I'll like, my accent will switch, like go more and more in a, to a Frencher version of my English accent will go to a more Frencher accent, which I think is the case right now. And then like, if I spend more time in Japan, my accent goes actually way a bit more like Japanese-ish, which is something that shouldn't be happening, obviously, because I'm not Japanese, nor am I English. So it shouldn't, but happens.
Although to be fair, like when I visited Ireland, I absolutely developed what felt like a sympathetic accent. I started having that lilt, that little Irish lilt every now and then. I think I was totally aware of it, and I didn't want to offend anybody. I wasn't trying to be cool or fit in. Yeah. I couldn't help but absorb it. So in a way, maybe you should have absorbed that accent.
True. I mean, I don't mind it. Like, there was a time I tried to control it. Now I've kind of given up on this. I'm like, yeah, if my accent wants to go there, it will. Like, this happens, especially when I speak to like people who have like a very strong British accent. And like, they'll go like with like strong, I think it's from London, like the London accent, like where they go like better or like butter, and like they don't pronounce the T's. And like, I take this after a while.
Well, if you were in Connecticut, you would say kitten, mitten, yeah.
Really? That's the thing, like for like American accents, I can distinguish that people will not be from the same area, but I have no idea which area has which accent, apart from Texas, which is...
So for those who are hearing this conversation and they're like, huh, I watch a lot of TV, I could put some closed captions on, what advice do you have for them?
Well, go ahead. It's not as hard as it might feel like. It's just slow. It might be slow. Obviously, not everybody has as much time as I did back then. But what's the rush? We have time, especially now with Netflix, Amazon, etc., Amazon and Prime, etc. It's like videos, like good TV shows everywhere and easily accessible. There are extensions online to, you know, like to set double subtitles, double language subtitles. So that can be a good, like that's something I use for all my TV shows now. I always have at least one language that I'm not so fluent in as a subtitle. So just have fun. And there's no rush to speak. And I think now my accent has changed quite a bit. But when I started speaking English, the very first time I started like actually speaking it, I had a very American accent. Now it's changed because I've had like some other influence. But in like when I first started speaking English, I didn't have a French accent. I had an American accent. I don't know from where, but I had an American accent because I didn't force my mouth to make sounds that weren't natural for it. I just got my ear used to it after like hundreds of hours of TV shows. And then when I spoke, it just came out naturally. So no rush.
When you would be really focusing on learning a new language using this method of watching TV, was there always a moment where you were like, oh my God, I think I've got it?
I had a bunch of smaller realization like this, like smaller, like, oh, I got that joke. I laughed at the same time as the like backtrack. So I kind of miss them. I kind of miss like having this realization in English, at least. Obviously, I still have it in some other languages, little by little. But yeah, this is something I really enjoyed. I never had the whole, like, oh, I get the entire show. And like, I just got it, like, after a while, I would realize that, like, it's been a month that I haven't struggled to understand anything. And I'll be like, oh, right. It's like, when did that happen? So learning a language is basically, it happens so slowly. Like the brain like makes connections so slowly for this that we don't really notice we're getting better at it. And then all of a sudden we're good at it.
You make me think about how children, when they're raised with many languages, it's like my heart longs for that alternate life where,
where
somehow I was able to be exposed to as many languages as possible. There's no replicating that, of course, once our brains start to sort of harden. But by doing this, it is an uphill battle, but it can be done.
Yeah, it can be done. And like, I mean, it's not impossible to do the same. It's just that like we're not as patient as children are. Like they listen to the language for like thousands and thousands of hours before like they say their first, like they actually make a sound. So like I would be happy to find a single person who like waited thousands of hours of not hearing any other language than just their target language and not saying a word for like just, yeah, thousands of hours and then try to speak it. That would be a great experiment to see, but I doubt we'll ever see it.
And maybe this is for another show about another topic, but I think about if there were a way to put a USB in the back of our heads and upload any language we want, what that would do to languages.
Yeah, indeed. I think that's a whole other conversation. But I don't know I would probably do it, but I would not upload. Like, for instance, if I could do it to myself, I would probably do it, but not for all languages, because there are some languages I wish I could learn, like some languages which are like difficult to learn, like difficult to get access to resources. I would probably do it for them, especially like dialects and endangered languages. There's a few that come to mind. I knew Burmese, etc. Those are languages that are difficult to find and to learn. So I would probably do it for those. But apart from this, for like major languages, the pleasure of learning, of discovering the language, discovering the culture, yeah, it's priceless.
Well, Matthias Berra, merci, arigato.
Thank you.
Kamsahamnida, gracias, jejeni, and thank you for talking with me.
Thank you, Kayan. It was a pleasure.
After the break, one woman surpassed her goal of getting over 100 rejections in a year, and I give her one more. For old time's sake.
Thank you, you compliment sandwiched me. Oh, but the straight up no was so funny.
I'm Kyone Wolf. This is Audacious. Be right back. This is Audacious. I'm Kyone Wolf. When was the last time you got rejected? Maybe it was a job you really wanted, or you didn't get the role in the school play. Or maybe there was a very beautiful and intriguing acquaintance you asked out on a date, and they just don't see you that way. Sorry. And sometimes rejections aren't even given, right? Maybe the people at the job you really wanted never even confirmed that they got your resume, or the cast list just didn't have your name on it. Or the person you asked out, they just left your message on read. Part of why there are so many feelings behind rejection is because of the extremes. You're taking a risk by applying, by trying out, by asking for the date. And then there's that suspension of time, weeks, days, moments, where all the possibilities of how your life could splinter off into a new path just explode in your imagination, and then no thanks. Or worse. That's a lot of feelings right there. Emily Winter, a comedy writer based in LA, decided in 2018 to load all of those feelings into a feeling cannon, aim it directly at herself, and light the fuse over 100 times. She asked for writing jobs in film and print. She reached out about stand-up gigs at small clubs and applied to be on stage at big comedy festivals. By the end of the year, she got 101 rejections, but she also got 39 acceptances. Like the op-ed she wrote for the New York Times about her year of magical rejections. And the first line of it goes, "My dog wags her tail whenever I say no." So I asked her to tell me about her dog, Bingo.
We just put Bingo down like 2 weeks ago, and it was, we're crying. My husband and I were like crying last night. We're still a mess.
I'm so sorry, Emily.
Oh no, it's totally fine. She would always like, if you were like, no, she would just wag her tail. And I'm sure that there is like pet psychology to this, but I basically, what had happened was I just had just been rejected from a job at the Daily Show. And I had gotten so close to getting that job. And I have been rejected from a million jobs before then, but to get to the interview stage, and then and it's down to three people, and then for it not to go to me was like so heartbreaking. So I was just, I felt like I was at the end of my rope, and I was like, what am I? I'm trying to be a comedian and trying to be a professional writer, and I can't get these jobs. And I get so, I just felt like always the bridesmaid of that sort of situation. So I just had to like reframe, and I was looking at my dog wagging her tail when I would say no. And I was like, I got to do that. Otherwise I have to quit. Otherwise I have to quit. I move back to the Midwest and open a muffin shop, and that's fine too, but I can't live in this middle ground anymore. So that is where my rejection project sort of came from.
Okay. So you committed to 100 rejections in a year. Where did you start? How did you launch into this?
The one good thing about being a comedian is that there are so many opportunities for rejection. They're everywhere. So there are so many things that I wanted to do. There's obviously like the TV writing jobs, which are amazing. I had always wanted to write for The New Yorker and their Shouts and Murmurs. And when I was in my 20s, I was like, you know what? When I'm in my 30s, I'll be smart enough. And then I was in my 30s and I was like, I think I might just be too dumb for this. And I never tried. So that I was like, I just like didn't have the confidence. And so something like trying for that was huge. And then doing stand-up comedy, just like asking for better and better and better opportunities, like shows. You just, you know, you can email, you can send a message on social media. Can I do your show? Can I work at your club? Can I come here for a weekend and do this? And wow, you can get rejected so quick, so many times.
Wait. Were there any like ways that you were rejected that were kind of beautiful?
Oh, what a good question. I've never been asked that before. No. You know what? Actually, honestly, I believe that every rejection that is a clear rejection is beautiful, because getting like professionally ghosted is such a common thing now. And I was doing some research on it, and it's like 56% of job applicants say that not hearing back anything is their most frustrating part of applying for jobs. And I totally agree with that. So like, honestly, every rejection that was like, hey, not you, not at this time, no thanks, is so much better than not hearing anything. And I understand that like people don't have the bandwidth to respond to every single email and every single application, but I so appreciate when they do.
Were there any rejections that stood out in any way whatsoever?
There was one guy in comedy, and I can't even remember what I had asked him for. It wasn't a show. I think it was to come and, oh, it was to come and be on my podcast that I had at the time called How to Produce Live Comedy, because I did a lot of comedy show producing as well. But yeah, so like, I was like, come do my podcast because you know how to plan out of town shows really well. And he was like, I'm not telling anyone my secrets. And I was like, what a weird way of looking at the world. Like, people still have to execute and do it. Like, it's still going to be tons of hard work on their part. Like, I just didn't understand that. And he was so mad about it. I mean, some people are just rude, which just unnecessary when you're already being vulnerable and putting yourself out there. So I always try to, when I'm in a position, because I've been a boss before and I've run comedy shows where we have to decide who to put on the comedy show. When I'm in a position of power like that, I always try to remember what it feels like to be vulnerable. Because it's just, it's hard. It's hard even just asking for a spot on a comedy show down the street. You know, it's still a tough thing to do, and we're all going through it. And we just all need to remember that, you know, in any creative field or any, honestly, any field, we're all putting ourselves out there and getting rejected. And it's just tough.
It sounds like you're saying that the way that one rejects someone, if they even ever do, says a lot about them.
Absolutely. That's such a good way of putting it. I always think when I'm trying to reject somebody with, and I, you know, they've given me a lot and I'm trying to say that's not for me, I always do compliment sandwich, which is you say something nice and then you say, but not for me. And then you say something nice again so that they can leave the interaction feeling like, hey, this is what was appreciated about my submission or whatever. Okay, it didn't work out. And most rejections aren't even about you or about the work you're putting forward. It's really about what the other person needs at that moment. And so they can leave without feeling totally destroyed, because like we're all so fragile. And the more people I talk to about this, the more I realize like we are all so fragile. We just show it in different ways.
So since the way that one goes about rejecting may say a lot about them, what do you think seeking out these rejections and the ways in which you receive them reveals about you?
Well, it revealed, one, that I am a little bit smarter than I thought. Like, I ended up getting 107 rejections, but I got 43 acceptances, and one or two of those was from The New Yorker. And my first submission to The New Yorker was accepted. And I spent like a couple of weeks, like every day, going over it, changing little things before I submitted. I really put everything into it, and I got it. And I'm like, I might not be the smartest person in the room, but like, if I work hard, I can get there, you know? And then there's so much evidence to back this up. Like, I love Angela Duckworth's book. She's a psychologist, her book, Grit, which is all about, her studies have shown across all, not just creative fields, across all fields, and with children and in the army, and that hard work, if you put in the work, you can get what you want. You can't get everything you want all the time, but it proved to me that I really could do that.
Yeah, you can't have everything. Where would you put it?
Right, exactly. And I learned how empowering it is to do something like this. And I think the whole world took a couple years off of New Year's resolutions because we are all in survival mode over the last few years. And I feel like this is the perfect time to talk about this, because we're all trying to get back into the world. Like, we're all just trying now to be people again. And so it's a good time to think about what will empower you. And I think having something that you can control, like saying, I'm going to get 100 rejections, like I'm going to try for 100 rejections, rather than saying like, I want to get published in this publication, and if I don't, I'm a failure. You can't control that. You know, if The New Yorker had said no, I still would have gotten 42 acceptances and 108 rejections. And it's helped me learn how to proceed with other hard things.
Yeah, you'd mentioned in your New York Times article about all this that you'd actually connected with the author you just mentioned, Angela Duckworth, about her book, Grit, The Power and Passion of Perseverance. And she sort of soothed you and said that you were actually practicing a sort of exposure therapy. Yeah.
Yeah. She talks about it like practicing rejection, and rejection is all around us. We get rejected all the time, every day, in big and small ways. And to just sort of throw yourself in, you are practicing rejection so that the next time you experience rejection, it doesn't hurt as much. And it's true. I mean, you know, I still definitely go through hard times for sure, but the professional rejection of it all is like, it stings less to my core of who I am. I think I've learned a little bit to separate. There is Emily, the person, the whole complete package, and then like there's this other layer, and that's the professional, and it's okay. You're going to get rejected. It's fine. It doesn't mean that I'm a bad person. Yeah.
All this makes me think about how when we're younger, and we experience rejection, it feels like regardless of what it is, there's one part that's like, you don't want to play? Oh, okay. On to the next one.
Right.
And there's also like another part of you that feels like, you don't want to play? What? And the older you get, the more you get hurt and experience the chaos of being a human being for a little while, you do get better at recognizing that the world still turns mm-hmm. when you don't get what you want and when things feel unjust. But it's been a couple of years since you published this and did this experiment. So since then, how has it changed you?
I mean, I'm hardened, but like it's hard because practicing rejection makes the rejection sting less, but you still want to have like an open, this is cheesy, but you want to have like an open heart to the world. Like if you just say nothing affects me, that's not a way to live either. Like you have to like let it happen and like have these horrible moments and these low moments. But it's so weird how we just, when we get to these like really low places, we feel so alone. And it's just like what I've learned, and just so many people telling me their own stories since I did this project and since I published that article, people just saying, I went through this. I was depressed for 6 months. I thought that nobody would ever love me again or nobody would ever hire me again. This is a universal story. And our brains trick us into thinking that it's not when we're at our lowest. And so I think having a few years behind me on this project, it just really reiterates to me that we're not alone. And I had to keep reminding myself of this in a different way when my dog recently passed. And I just was like, I don't think anyone has ever felt as sad as I feel right now. And that's absolutely not true. And then when you talk to people, you're reminded that you're not alone. And that's so, so, so important. And that's why we all have to be kind to each other, because we all get to these places and they're not fun.
Well, that being said, would you like me to reject you for old time's sake?
Oh, please reject me. Please give me a rejection.
Let's see. What can you ask that I can reject you for?
So how many times is the show on?
It airs Saturday morning at 10, right before Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Ugh.
And then Wednesday night at 11, and then eternally on podcast and internet.
Okay. Can I have your show once a month?
Oh, like be in my slot?
Yeah, I'll take your slot once a month, yeah.
The one right before Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me?
Yeah, that one. That one, I'd like that.
Oh, no. But you're very nice.
Thank you.
I am not going to give you my slot right before Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And I am so excited to see what you do in the future. Huh?
Thank you. You compliment sandwiched me. but the straight up no was so funny. Can I tell you, there is something so hilarious about just being so blunt. I mean, I subscribe to the compliment sandwich, but so I work on a Nickelodeon show. I'm writing for a Nickelodeon show right now. And the kid that's the star she's really funny, but she's a no nonsense. Like she's a, 80 year old, like mean grandma in a 15 year old's body. And I love her for it. But I was so sad about my dog dying. And I know her dog recently passed like, 5 months ago or something. And I was like, hey, her name's Lele. I was like, hey, Lele, do you have any advice for getting over your dog when they die? And she was like, you'll never get over it. And it will always be terrible. And I cracked up so hard because I'm like, you know what? Sometimes what you need to hear is so blunt and painful that it's actually just hilarious. I don't believe her, by the way.
No.
I think I'll be fine.
I think you'll be all right, yeah. Well, did I miss anything? Is there anything that you want to add about this project that you did back in 2018, seeking out 100 rejections in a year?
Well, I think one thing that people sort of misinterpret sometimes about the rejection project, because I urge like anybody to try it. And like, listen, if you're in a field where you cannot absolutely accumulate 100 rejections in a year, go for 50 or go for 25 or whatever is normal for what you're doing, But I've heard a couple people since I did this complain, I tried to, become a stand-up comedian and I had never done it before. And I asked Netflix for a special on Twitter 100 times and they didn't give it to me. And I'm like, you have to put in the work too. Like you can't just, I mean, you can go around the world asking for things and sometimes people will give them to you, but like, I think you have to put in the work and the time and the practice, no matter what your field is. And it's not a replacement for doing the work. It's a way of counting the work that you're doing so that even when you have rejections, you're still winning, right? It's about like reframing the way that those losses come at you. Because actually, every loss was a win when I was counting rejections, because it got me a little bit closer to my goal.
Well, Emily Winter, congratulations on your rejections, and thank you for talking with me.
Thank you so much for having me. This was so fun. I'm so excited.
Audacious is always lovingly produced by me, Jessica Severin DiMartinez, Khalil Rahman, Meg Fitzgerald, and Katie Talarski at Connecticut Public Radio in Hartford. Make it a goal to listen to Audacious once a week, at least. You can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or at ctpublic.org/audacious. You can go ahead and reject me for whatever, really. I mean, just get it off your chest on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Kyone Wolf, or shun me via email at audacious@ctpublic.org. Thanks for listening. I am gonna make it through this year. If it kills me,